This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to this People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday and Wednesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our site, www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. That's www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. And now all our friends can listen live via satellite on your Nokia phones. Just go to the website for details. We're thrilled to have I'm a personal fan of this guest, and I know many, many of you are. Our guest tonight is Dan Millman. Dan is a former world champion athlete, university coach, martial arts instructor, college professor, and the author of over 24 books. One of his books that we'll be discussing in depth tonight is The Life You Were Meant to Live, A Guide to Your Purpose. I'm sure you all remember one of Dan's most famous to-date book and the later movie called The Way of the Peaceful Warrior. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the People Speak Radio.
Hi, Bess. I'm glad to be here with you.
Well, it's an honor. There are so many... There are so many good things about this, but what I don't want to pass over The Way of the Peaceful Warrior too quickly, just because it impacted my life, it impacted my son's life. When I first came across The Peaceful Warrior and Socrates, I looked at it and I started reading the first chapter, and all I could see was this guy, you know, and you're talking about sports, and I'm thinking, why is this book in my life? And I forced myself to read it because at that point in my life, I knew that there were books that were entering into my life for a purpose. And so I forced myself to get past the first chapter, which was all very male-dominated, and it was amazing. It was one of the most spiritual books that I'd ever read. I still struggle sometimes, and I think especially in a day today, Dan, with war and what's happening in the world, I still struggle sometimes with the path of the peaceful warrior, because it almost seems like it's a struggle to be a peaceful warrior in a time of war.
Well, I would certainly
agree. How do you feel?
You know, you... Before we went on the air, you mentioned we had a great connection here. You know, like the phone sound was good, but I think we have a great connection in other ways as well. and I think maybe for some of your listeners who aren't really familiar with me or my work, I might give a kind of segue from how I went from a young athlete, also depicted in the movie based on my first book. The movie is titled Peaceful Warrior. Nick Nolte stars as the old gas station attendant that I called Socrates. He wouldn't tell me his real name, so he reminded me of the old Greek sage, so I started calling him by that name. And so many people have maybe seen the movie or heard about the movie who haven't even read the book yet, and the film only covers about the first two-thirds of the book, loosely, but they did a nice job. So people are maybe thinking, well, this is kind of, I don't know if this is going to be interesting or not. What is a peaceful warrior? It sounds like an oxymoron. How can you be peaceful and a warrior, which is what you were leading up to as well. And really, what the term means, it came about when I was a young college professor in physical education, and I was teaching a rather unusual course, a compendium of two martial arts, Tai Chi and Aikido, which are both more internal, more peaceful arts, at least on the surface. And I wanted to call the course The Way of the Warrior, because way means vehicle or means or a path to our evolution from the Zen tradition. And at the time, I was watching an old TV series, which was one of my favorites back in the 70s, called Kung Fu, with David Carradine as Kwai Chang Kane. And he was a Shaolin monk, and he was very peaceful, but also he had mastered the martial arts. So I decided to call the course The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, to kind of modify just this aggressive, you know, just fighting, warlike energy. It had a certain balance to it. It was more about living with a peaceful heart, but also a warrior spirit that we need at times, because it takes courage to live in this world and to love in this world. So it's not enough just to be peaceful and passive and nourishing and kind. That's wonderful. Nor is it enough for someone to be tough and strong and, you know, assertive. We need both of those things in our lives. So this idea of balance surrounds this approach to life that I teach. So I went from being a young athlete focused on talent for sports, and over the years my interest evolved, to make this story short, into not just developing a talent for sport, but a talent for living, understanding what life was about, how to live smoothly in our relationships, in our health, in our financial challenges, and all these things we face in everyday life. And I traveled around the world. I didn't just meet an old guy in a gas station and learn a bunch from him. I've actually had a number of different mentors over more than two decades now. And that evolved into 14 books, actually. You were kind enough to introduce me as author of 24, but
oh, I'm
14.
Sorry, that was on our site. We'll have to adjust that.
That's quite all right. But that led to what I do now, and which is write and speak worldwide. And of course, I might mention, just anybody who's curious to know a little bit more, see some video clips and so on, can go to my website, which is peacefulwarrior.com or danmillman.com, but most people don't know how to spell Millman, M-I-L-L-M-A-N. So peacefulwarrior.com, or someone can Google me and find that information. And so there we are. That, I think, that brings us up to date in terms of what we mean by peaceful warrior, peaceful heart, warrior spirit. It's not some esoteric path just for me and a few cultic, people who are into that. This really describes all of us, because everywhere I look, I see peaceful warriors in training. As you noted, Basima, that this is a difficult world, and we all have challenges today. We'd like the world to be a better place, and we're looking for ways to exert the right leverage to do that. And so that's what I do. I continue to teach, offering certain principles, practices, and perspectives that are really reminders of what we all know at deeper levels, but we tend to forget. And with that long monologue, I will be silent for a while.
Well, I think the monologue is appropriate, because it helps people to understand exactly where you're coming from. You know, one of the words today that when we hear this, what sounds almost like an oxymoron, the peaceful warrior, another word that comes to my mind, because I am Palestinian by heritage, and is jihad, because to us, jihad actually meant the struggle. And I think that that's really encompassed in everything, that there is a struggle in life, and that there are ways to handle that. And the book, The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, was very eloquent in how it handled certain situations. And I just thought it was really a beautiful, but I have to tell you, even then, I struggled with my own ethnicity. I struggled with how do you maintain peacefulness in light of these issues? How do you create peacefulness, say, in a situation such as Israel and Palestine, which was foremost in my mind as an activist? And it was a very difficult process. But in the end, and I will always say this, only peace can happen. And the struggle is not about war. The struggle is about the struggle.
Yes, and of course, as you and I know, and hopefully more people are waking up to, the term jihad really refers to the battle inside. Socrates once said, I call myself a peaceful warrior because the important battles we fight are inside of us. And
exactly.
When people have conquered their inner demons, they're in a better position to be more effective in life and to try to make peace. You know, one of my more recent books is called The Journeys of Socrates. It's a life story of the old man. And specifically what this book is about, its larger theme, is not only why a man became a warrior, but how a warrior found peace, how to break the cycles of retribution that plague our world today. I'm so glad you told me about your background. My daughter, who is Phi Beta Kappa from Stanford and went to journalism school, and she's a journalist living in Beirut, Lebanon right now studying Arabic. She has many dear friends in the Palestinian territory, let's say now, and she has a great sympathy for rational solutions and real information to understand the balance of what is going on there. I have my own ideas about it if you'd like to hear any of them.
Oh, I would love to. I absolutely. And I think it's important. Most of the people that we bring on these shows are involved not only in the acts of heroic spiritualism, as I consider you to be, but also in heroic politics and heroic parts of life that, as far as I'm concerned, is something that we are going to have to face. So please enlighten us.
Well, let me start with a story, because stories are a good way to convey energy and ideas. In this story, this was during the Vietnam War, another time of war, I was doing a great deal of work on myself. Socrates was helping with it, teaching me this bone massage, so doing this self-massage. It took 6 hours to clear fear-produced tensions from the body. I was doing self-analysis, self-reflection, self-awareness exercises, self-this and self-that. And at the time, he and I were walking down the street, and we saw posters about starving children and oppressed peoples. And I said, you know, Soc, just casually making conversation, but it was quite sincere. I said, I feel kind of guilty or selfish or self-centered doing all this work on myself when there are so many people in the world in need out there. Shouldn't I be more of an activist? And he didn't say anything at first. I started asking him again, and he turned to me all of a sudden and said, I'll give you $10 if you can slap me on the cheek. And I said, what? Did you hear what I was just saying? He said, come on. And he started, you know, kind of playing with me, slapping me a little bit. And I figured it was some kind of test. So I went for it, and I tried to give him a slap. And the next thing I knew, I found myself on the ground in a rather painful wrist lock. I mean, he was very good at the martial arts. And as he let me to my feet, he said, you know, you notice how a little leverage can be very effective, Dan? And I said, yeah, I noticed. He said, well, if you want to help people, of course, do what you're moved to do at your present state of awareness, you know. But he said, also, don't abandon the work on yourself to develop the clarity and the courage and the compassion to know, finally, how to exert the right leverage at the right place at the right time to really be effective in the world. So this whole idea of should we abandon, quote-unquote, navel-gazing, you know, looking inside, the Eastern kind of solution to happiness, or should we just become political activists and fight to make a difference, or should we become both? And the way of the peaceful warrior is about both. It's not either or. We work on ourselves so we can better be more effective in the world. And, you know, I believe the number one problem in the world today is the competitive mind. What I mean by that, it's an extension of the ego, the separate fearful self. I'm not against competitive sports and games. They can be amusing and, you know, stimulating and so on. But, for example, when I play a game of tennis, there's no opponent across the net for me. I see my teacher and my student. There's an old proverb, we have no friends, we have no enemies, we only have teachers. And what happens is most people see themselves as separate from everyone else. And this is the competitive mind. We have to overcome other people or defeat them in competition or rise above them to make our way in the world. And it's based on a fundamental illusion. You know, Einstein said that we can't solve a problem at the same level of awareness at which it was created. And so many people look to a wounded place in the world right now, the Middle East, and particularly the conflict, this ergonomic problem, because two people saying this is our land. And you can certainly argue, you know, there's a wonderful book called The Lemon Tree, which talks about, from the viewpoint of both a Palestinian refugee and an Israeli, basically, occupier from their viewpoint. And you understand both their historical reasons for saying this is our land. More recently, many people were disenfranchised when the Israelis moved in, the settlers moved in. They were pushed out in the early 40s or the mid-40s. And the late 40s, of course. Anyways, I don't want to go on too long, but to understand this area, it's a problem spot in the world, and it represents the tribalism, the turf wars, the competition with a somebody and an other. And while the Israelis, those who view the Palestinians as other, and while the Palestinians view the Israelis as other, we have conflict, especially at the extremes. And until we realize that we are all cells on this living creature called planet Earth, every one of us, and the better each cell, the better it is for the whole body, until we realize we are part of the same body, all of us, then they'll continue to be these conflicts. But when we realize we are part of the same body, fighting another people, another religion, another group is like the eye fighting the ear, you know, like the leg fighting the arm. It's insane.
It is absolute insanity, and I really, really appreciate your position in bringing to light that it isn't just about being an active. It isn't just about being a warrior. It's about being all of those things. And I think one of the things that we've forgotten in our world today is the element of discernment. And in the way of the peaceful warrior, Socrates taught discernment in so many ways to you. It was very clear, and it was very, very much appreciated. Great book. Anyway, that is, and you provided me with another wonderful book, Dan, called The Life You Are Meant to Live, A Guide to Your Life Purpose. It's completely different from The Way of the Peaceful Warrior in that, this book is more of a manual, for determining certain innate qualities that may not, may not be fully attached to or have access to. And this is a tool that I found was just incredibly simple. This book is jam-packed with unbelievable amounts of information, yet you've set it up to be a cinch in accessing the information in a way that's readable, interesting, thought-provoking. I can only say congratulations. This was a real true feat because I've read many books that are like this, Dan, but this particular one has to be one of the easiest and most pleasant to maneuver. I think it's great. Now, the book. I took this book with me on vacation with my girlfriends. And oh my God, we had more tears over the issues that were determined. First of all, the book is based somewhat on numerology. Can you tell me what attracted you to a numerology style book?
Sure. Actually, I wasn't particularly attracted to numerology. And I'm not really putting it down, but just personally, I glanced at a few such books in bookstores, and it really didn't make much sense to me how just adding up the numbers, your date of birth or your name, really connected up in any meaningful way I could find to valid, reliable, accurate information. And most of it, what I read, seemed about 40% accurate. But then, as part of my journey, one of the mentors that I had studied with, he did a reading for me once, and it was so uncanny. It was so accurate. It was this: if a light was shining in the darkness, things I'd been stumbling over my whole life were suddenly clear. I could see them, and strengths that I didn't know I had, fully appreciate. There it was, and I went, "Wow, that is so accurate." I said, "Are you a psychic?" He said, "No, but I've been trained to know where to look." Well, later on, he was teaching in advanced training and for very few people in Hawaii. And when I said, you mean you're going to talk about this? You mean I can learn to do for other people what you did for me to clarify these issues of my life and give me particular spiritual laws to work on to overcome those hurdles? And he said, yes. Well, I was there. And most of the people learn the information just for their own curiosity, but I immediately went home. I had taken about 20 pages of notes, and I immediately went home and started doing readings for anyone who would listen, reading off the notes, and they were going, wow, that's accurate. And then I began planning. I internalized the knowledge, and I started doing readings for people, first in person and then audio tape, for about 8 years, until finally I felt it was time. I'd really gotten much more insight. I only had 20 pages of notes to start with. And then I began to teach this to physicians, psychotherapists, and various people, body workers, people who work with other people. And then it struck me, I'd better write a book about it. This is the time to do it. So that's when I wrote The Life You Were Born to Live. The title, by the way, some people are vaguely interested in how books get their title. We didn't know what to call it. We were going to call it The Number Book, the Book of Life Purpose. But my wife and I were walking through the living room one day when our daughters were watching, when they were younger, they were watching The Sound of Music, and the Mother Superior was saying to Maria, right at that moment, she said, Maria, you have to go out and find the life you were born to live. And we went, that's it, we got goosebumps, and that's when we ended up calling the book by that title. And so even though it is numerologically based, in other words, you do use the numbers from one's date of birth, add them up in a particular way. The rest of it is simply a tool of, among many that I've learned, the most accessible tool and means to clarify one core issue of one's life purpose. I'm actually doing a cruise, as you probably know, in September, and many people are joining me on that cruise, maybe 75 or 100, and it's going to focus on the four purposes of life, and one of those purposes is the one described in The Life You Were Born to Live.
Well, that's wonderful. And for those of our listeners, you can find out more about the cruise on Dan's website. Dan, what is the website again?
It's peacefulwarrior.com. PeacefulWarrior, peacefulwarrior.com. And right on the homepage there, there's a big link to click to find out much more about the Life Purpose Cruise in September.
And for those that don't know and have never attended an intensive workshop such as this one that Dan is presenting, it's an unimaginable experience. It really is. I've attended many, including workshops with Deepak Chopra, and just some of the most amazing experiences. So for those of you interested, it's really a great thing. But again, back to the book. You know, you say that in the book, labels, you never attach to a label because they can, and they are pitfalls, and you're warning because labels do impose a limit on a human being. And when someone becomes labeled like me, I'm a 32-5, and we found ourselves, we almost invariably, as my group of friends sat around and we discussed this over a period of 2 days, we invariably kept looking back at, I'm a 32.5, you're a 26.3, you're a, and back and forth. And it was, and we had to keep reminding ourselves, these are not labels. Do not be defined fully by them. But the uncanniness was amazing. We live in a mathematical universe. Does the mathematics, the fact that we can understand the mathematical universe, help to guide you in the work that this book kind of led in the direction of?
Well, yes. In fact, most of us have heard of Pythagoras. He's known as the father of geometry. However, mm-hmm. he also had a mystery school, and one of the things that he did in his mathematical researches was he was one of the first Westerners to ask, do numbers have an archetypal meaning? Most of us have heard of archetypes, the wizard, the crone, the king, the warrior, the mischief maker. These are all images of types of people that live in almost every culture, mythic types. We call them archetypes. And so Pythagoras asked, do numbers have meaning? Does one mean something in the human psyche, in the human world, that two is different from two? not just to count objects, but do they have this innate meaning? And three, and how does it relate to human life? Well, that's what numerology developed out of. Now, there was also Chinese numerology, Babylonian, you know, Hebrew numerology, many different kinds in different cultures. But the world has eventually adapted to the Gregorian calendar. That's the most recent one because it more accurately reflects the cycles of the sun and the moon and so on. And the way I would look at it, you talking about labels and how we shouldn't be defined by numbers, for sure, which I point out in the book. one way to put it is this. If I were to point to a tree outside your office, my office, chances are there's not a single tree on the planet exactly like that tree in the angle of every branch and leaf and stem. So in the same way, you and I are unique. There's nobody exactly like us. Even if we're identical twins, there's nobody exactly like us. And yet, I can point to a redwood tree, and there are things that apply to a redwood tree that are different from a birch or oak or aspen. So even though we're each unique, we are working, falling into certain patterns. And as it happens, there are 37 life paths or patterns for people born in the 1900s. For children born after 2000, it's a bit different. And in the back of the book, I say a few words about kids born after 2000. But for most of us, we're on one of 37 life paths. And that's what the book describes to help clarify that for people. But of course, we have our own genetics. We have our own life experience. So we have differences. So each person, even though there may be millions of people working the same life path, they don't look identical. They do have that in common, no doubt about it. But they also have their unique individuality. So I like to say I'm working this life path or that life path rather than I am, you know, a 268 or whatever. So, and every path, there's no path that's better or worse than any other. They're all different. They have different challenges, different strengths. That's what makes us so interesting as people.
Well, Dan, at the risk of sounding a little bit too clinical, how did you determine the 37, that there were only the 37 life paths during the
Well, it's purely mathematical. If you start with January 1st, 1900, and you go all the way up to the end of, you know, 1999, for that 100 years, you can add up the numbers in various ways, but they'll come out 37 different sums or totals. And page 4 of The Life You Were Born to Live shows how to add up the numbers properly. It's very simple, but you don't want to do it carefully. You don't want to make any adding mistakes. And then you get a number. Now, that number doesn't mean much to people, but that's what the book is for, to then look up their life path. And what's interesting is not just looking up one's own life path, but looking up the life paths of one's parents or one's children or significant others or spouses, ex-spouses. You can learn a lot. And the book is designed not as some party game because, you know, so many people, they learn something about themselves and they spend half their day analyzing their craziness and the other half of the day dramatizing it. So it's not about just, oh, I'm this way, I'm that way. But the most important part of the book, it gives specific spiritual laws, as I mentioned before, to overcome the hurdles on that particular life path, to work that path more in a positive way. Some people have a lot of expressive energy, and they're going to be expressing in the positive, or they're going to be expressing in the negative, but they are going to be expressing. Other people have a lot of creative energy, and some of them create in the positive. They create a new software program, and others create in the negative. They go and create a virus. So why people make those choices is a bit more complex, but the book goes into each life path and describes what it's like to work that path in the positive, what it's like in the negative, so people can get more insight into when they do one or the other.
Well, it certainly is a thought-provoking book, if nothing more. Now, this is something that was kind of interesting that happened to us. I can't add my fingers to my toes, Dan, just so you know. And so I gave, we read off the birth dates to a friend of ours who was brilliant in mathematics, and she managed to muck up two of the numbers. She forgot to add the 1900 to each of the, and we got different numbers. But we didn't know this until after we had read. And one of the things that I had found, and I always said this, I said, there's no mistake. The universe does not have mistakes. And those two numbers were so they literally brought the two people that we were talking to tears. And I believe, and that was when, for me, the issue of labeling yourself under one, because we knew these people. We understood how their personalities manifested, how their behaviors manifested, and we were able to identify certain aspects of that with the behaviors of our friends. And it still was an incredible journey for them. I thought that to be quite fascinating. And, you know, again, it brought back to the reality that there is no such thing as a label or encompassing someone in some kind of a prison of a label. And that's what
I make that pretty clear in the book. That's why the introductory material is so important to understand the context of the system. However, you know, I wish I knew what numbers and I mean, that's why I go to pains in the beginning of the book to make sure you include the 1-9 for the 1900 when you add up the numbers. Now, some people, for example, I'm not going to go into the numbers now because listeners who don't know the book, it's not going to make much sense to them. But what it sounds like, your description, that they got an entirely different number. Actually, it may not be entirely different. If I knew what number she got and which one she really was, what life path, they may have had similar numbers. For example, a 268 and a 246. They both have a 2 and a 6. So there's going to be certain qualities that are going to be relevant. Without going into any more detail about that for listeners who are unfamiliar with the system, let me just say that the book is not an oracle. Now, understand what an oracle is. An oracle, like the I Ching, the Chinese Book of Changes, or the Tarot, or runes, the Nordic runes, these are... They're oracles. They give general kind of vague information, and the person reads that information, sees the image on the tarot card, or sees the word like strength or perseverance, picking it out a rune out of a bag, and they go, wow, this is perfect for what I need right now. But the wisdom is not in the oracle. It's in themselves, in their own subconscious. Now, I could have written a book that was an oracle. I could have written a book that all the life paths applied, and it didn't really matter which one you pick. You'll find wisdom, but that is not what the book is about. So someone might pick or misadd the numbers and still find themselves some meaning in what they come across. But when they do the numbers correctly, it's going to then really hit them over the head. So again, no, we're not prisoners of a number. And I could go, if this were, you know, on my cruise, I'm going to go into a lot more depth so people really understand behind the system, how to use it, how to work with other people using the system. We're even going to go into some archetypal past life material, how to access that using this particular system to teach them where to look. And it helps open intuitive sight, which we'll be doing work on in the cruise as well. It's really designed to find the correct number, not just kind of read into another one and say, yeah, there's some elements in that that apply to me too. So maybe off the air sometime I can find out what those numbers were. I'd be curious on my own, but probably best to move on from that at this point.
Well, in fact, some of the numbers were similar, and I noticed that later on, although it was very difficult getting the book away from my girlfriends. One of them even had it during the whole trip on the way back from Florida. So, I mean, it was they really did enjoy it. I just have to tell you, we thoroughly appreciated that book. It really was an eye-opener for a lot of us.
Well, I appreciate it. And again, The Life You Were Born to Live is only one of my 13 books. And people who've read 5 or 6 or 7 of them are usually amazed by how different each one is. It's a strength and a weakness of mine. The strength is I don't just write the same book, put different title and covers on it. I know a few authors who tend to do much the same thing each time. Each one has to justify itself for the time and effort to write it. And so when you read one book, you think, oh, now I understand what Dan's about. But that's not really true. It's like the old story about the, you know, 6 blind men who came to the elephant and experienced different parts. One held the ear, one held the trunk, one held the leg and said, oh, an elephant is this or that. And if you come across The Life You Were Born to Live, you think Dan Millman's a numerologist. You come across Way of the Peaceful Warrior, you get a very different impression. You read The Journeys of Socrates. It's basically kind of an inspiring novel. You look at The Laws of Spirit. It's another kind of book, or No Ordinary Moments. So each of my books are different, but I was delighted today that you wanted to speak about The Life You Were Born to Live, because It is a very practical tool for self-knowledge, and all the spiritual traditions agree on the same thing. Know thyself. And the more we know ourselves, the better able we are to pick the right relationship for us, the better we are able to pick the right work, calling, and form of service, because we know who we are, what our values and interests and talents are. And what many young people struggle through their 20s and sometimes 30 or beyond, because they haven't really seen themselves realistically yet. They haven't found the tools to help understand themselves, so they pick a person who doesn't really fit, or a job that they say, I'm not really happy at this. So it's, self-knowledge is one of the major life skills, and I wrote this book to develop more knowledge and compassion for ourselves and other people.
Well, one thing I have to agree on is I was very surprised at the type of book that it was. I mean, going from The Way of the Peaceful Warrior and a couple of your other books, and then going to this, I thought, wow. This is, first of all, it was not what I was expecting. Second of all, as I started to read, I thought, okay, you know, we run across these kinds of books, but the ability of an author to be so diverse is really a very rare talent. And I don't see anything negative about it. I think it's a great positive in your case. I think you are doing it perfectly, and that your ability to expand on different areas of the spiritual path is really remarkable. What other work are you doing right now, Dan? I know you're preparing for the cruise.
What are
your latest books?
My latest book is called Wisdom of the Peaceful Warrior, Basima, and it was a wonderful opportunity. After 28 years after my first book was published, Way of the Peaceful Warrior, many, many people have had questions about something that the character of Socrates said, one of the teachings in the book. Many misunderstood, and even though I tried to make it as clear as I could in that first book through the story. And when the movie came out, you know, Nick Nolte playing Socrates, the screenwriter wrote certain lines I never wrote, which were very nice lines, like, you know, there's never nothing going on, and he told Dan to take out the trash, which is anything in your mind that separates you from the present moment, that sort of thing. But many people had questions about this, thinking the movie was my spiritual teaching, and the movie's a movie. So I decided it was time to write a book that brought way more clarity and shed new light on the original teachings. In fact, nobody truly understands my first book who hasn't read Wisdom of the Peaceful Warrior. And so my publisher gave me this wonderful opportunity to actually be able to further elucidate, clarify, and illuminate those original teachings. And that's my latest book, which came out maybe about 6 or 9 months, a year ago. And people are quite enjoying it. So it gives me a really kind of a sense of peace and completion that people finally really understand that first book. And that's why I found it necessary to write a number more to fully elucidate this path, this way of the peaceful warrior. You know, Stanislaw Lech wrote a book in a concentration camp during World War II, and he called it Unkempt Thoughts. And one of my favorite quotations from that book, he said, I wanted to tell the world just one word. Unable to do that, I became a writer.
Amazing.
So that's what happened with me.
Many people equate Socrates with the higher self. The interesting part of the book, and I wonder how Wisdom of the Peaceful Warrior engages that, because constantly Dan and Socrates were going back and forth. At one point you thought it was this higher spiritual self, and then there was this humanness about Socrates that was almost uncanny. And what was your intention behind who and what Socrates represented to your readers?
Well, let me answer in this way. At my homepage, peacefulwarrior.com, there's a little box right there on the homepage that says, who is Socrates? And because it's a common question I get. And if someone clicks on there, they get to see a little video, maybe a 5-minute video with me, describing exactly who Socrates is. And what I say in a nutshell here is that he was based on an actual old person. I didn't simply make up the character. I would tell you if I did, but he was based on an old cosmic old guy I met in an old Texaco gas station on the corner of Oxford and Hearst Streets in Berkeley, California, about 3 a.m. I was walking home from a late night date and decided to wander in there. And there was something about him that just drew me. I didn't know what it was. See, I was successful. I was a world champion on the trampoline, a good gymnast, and I was a good student, and had a girlfriend, and life was going well as a student life can go. And yet he had something I didn't have. There's a story about a wanderer in the forest many centuries ago who came upon a man who turned out to be the Buddha. But the wanderer didn't know who he was, and he was fascinated. He kept walking alongside the Buddha, looking at him. Finally, he got enough nerve, and he said, "Are you a wizard?" And the Buddha smiled and said, "No, I'm not a wizard." He said, "Well, are you some kind of king or a warrior?" And the Buddha said, "No." He said, "Well, what is it that makes you different from anyone I've ever met?" And the Buddha said, "Oh," he said, "I'm awake." And that's what struck me about that old guy in the gas station. He seemed awake. Maybe it was just a shining in his eyes or a smile, or the way he relaxed and breathed, the way he treated things kind of like life is a game we play as if it matters. He had a certain detachment and aloofness, a joy of living, a non-seriousness. He knew something. He understood something I didn't. So in a way, that kicked off my spiritual quest, and I wanted to find out what I could learn from him. And that's what I learned from him is described, of course, in The Way of the Peaceful Warrior. So if people only watch the movie, well, they made it kind of mysterious. You know, he disappears at the end. You wonder, was he ever really real? But, yeah, he was based on a real old guy.
And well, so how long was your association with him?
Well, it wasn't really all as – it wasn't as long, say, as I indicate in the book. From the time I met him in 1966 to the time I wrote the book, actually, 14 years had passed. And in that time, I had a lot of life experience, traveled around the world, met different mentors. So when Socrates spoke in the book, it reflected my current state of understanding back then, in 1980. And that's why I wrote Wisdom of the Peaceful Warrior more recently, because I could express my own evolution and a further clarification 25 years, 28 years later.
I wonder if you should have called it As Socrates Grows.
For our listeners,
you can call and speak to our guest toll-free at 877-489-6350 or 888-228-4494. We'd also, and for anybody that is needs to listen to it and can't, you can always get this in our archives. To go to support our show, you can go to our comment section and talk to other people about each interview. We also have a site where you can donate to so that we can continue to put on and present wonderful shows like tonight's. We have a question from one of our emails for you, or they're starting to come in, and let me see, what is this question? George from Missouri asked Mr. Millman who were/are your heroes?
Well, it's a nice question. I already had mentioned one, though realistically he was a fictional character, which was Kwai Chang Kane, the fellow who played the Shaolin monk in Kung Fu, because I've had a lifelong interest in the martial arts as well. And I'd seen many, you know, people who are fighters, good fighters, but this fellow was a peaceful man. He believed in nonviolence, vegetarian, and so on. So it was an archetype for me that impressed me, and that impression shaped my work from then on. Now, some of my heroes were people I read, books that seemed to awaken me, people like Alan Watts. Many people don't know who he is even anymore, but he was a wonderful clarifier of the Zen tradition and Taoist tradition of China. And, of course, Ram Dass was an early inspiration. He kind of conveyed some ancient Indian wisdom. And I've had other people that your readers, I could mention names, but they haven't heard of probably, different mentors. I'm going to be writing a book on those, all those mentors and the spiritual search that's coming up in the near future, next year or so. But of course there are people like Harriet Tubman, who was an escaped slave in the South in early America, and she went back again and again risking her life to bring other people to freedom. She was a hero. Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., these were all peaceful warriors, peaceful heart, warrior spirit. So I think it's less important, my heroes, even though it's natural to be curious about that, as the heroes each of us pick in our own lives, and good role models. One thing that reflects inner wisdom is when people pick positive role models rather than negative ones, which unfortunately happens in some cases, because, you know, we all make the best choices available to us at the time, but some youngsters don't see other options for themselves. And my heart goes out to them, and that's partly why I do the work I do, to reach out to them. One of the blogs at my website, I have a number of commentaries on different topics. One of them is called The Trying 20s. And the reason why I call it The Trying 20s is because when you're 20 years old, and 25, 26, 27, you try this, then you try that. We're still learning about ourselves, and we're trying to find our work in the world and our way into a form of service in the world, a way to make a living that we enjoy and find meaningful. And there are, you know, blogs on relationships and others. I also have one in there about my favorite books. People have been pestering me for years, and I've hesitated to recommend books I've liked because a book that is right for me may not be right for someone else. But I finally accommodated and wrote, told about the books in my bookshelf, if anybody's curious. So that's all at the website. I try to give a lot of value there, just information. There's questions and answers about my work. All that's at peacefulwarrior.com as well.
Well, you heard where you can get it. We have another question from email from Helen from Manitoba, Canada.
Wonderful.
Her question is, are we following a path we cannot change, or do we create our own path? And then she continues, does the universe shape us?
Does the universe what us?
Shape us.
Oh, shape us.
Shape us,
yes. Ellen, thank you for that question. I think it's an excellent one, a very important one. I wish I had a clear, authoritative answer, but this kind of thing is more in the area of faith and belief. You see, I would define faith as the courage to live as if everything that happens to us is for our highest good and learning. Now, do I know that's true? No. But that's how I choose to live. That's a life of faith, in my view. So in the sense of, are we making choices? You know, I wrote a book called A Life You Were Born to Live. That sounds a lot like predestination. But then, yet I talk about the power of choice. In the laws of spirit, I talk about the law of choices, how we have free will and we make choices. So the question is life predetermined, or do we choose our destiny? The answer is both. For example, we are predestined, most of us, to be a male or female, though certainly surgically people have done the best to correct that in some fairly rare cases. We're predestined to live on planet Earth, most likely, most of our lifetime, or all of it. There are certain predestination that are obvious. So in other words, we're given the ballpark to play in, but how we play the game and the games we play are up to us. We're given a mountain to climb, but what path we take up that mountain, to some degree, is up to us, or at least how fast we travel it, or where we want to stop, or whether we want to continue on. So I think life is a mixture of what we're given and what we make of it. And I think that's the most practical and useful answer I could give. But there are some very interesting people out there who suggest, they're more the determinism school, there are people who say that even though we make choices, it's possible that there's nobody inside this body-mind, nobody actually there making the choices. They're all predetermined by our neurology, our conditioning, our DNA, our experiences. And the universe and the world around us can influence us, can impact us in such a way that our neurology changes and makes different choices. So people can learn. But it's possible, from one view, perhaps an enlightened view, that there's nobody really home. We think there's with a separate self making all these choices, like a little person sitting in a crane and pushing the levers. But maybe there's nobody there. Maybe it's just this body doing what it's kind of destined to do. Which is true? I don't know, but it's an interesting question, isn't it? And I thank you for asking it, Ellen.
Well, I think it's, I agree with you, it is certainly an interesting question. I think it's something that a lot of spiritualists have pondered for a long, long time. Ellen from Iowa, do you know Steven Seagal?
No, we have a slew of Ellens out there today.
Ellen from Iowa? First one was Helen. The first one was Helen, and this is Ellen.
Oh, thank you. I guess I didn't hear that. Ellen, I certainly know of Steven Seagal. I've got a black belt in Aikido, which is his primary art. He was one of the first Americans to actually open a dojo, a school of martial arts in Japan. He was quite good at Aikido, and then he went into acting and so on and so forth. But he's taught the same places I've taught at Omega Institute in New York and elsewhere at different times. But we never ran into each other, so I never actually met him. So I don't know him personally. I know of his work, and I've enjoyed a couple of his movies as well.
You know, this is a question that I've always wanted to ask. Did Socrates, the real Socrates, know that he was such a prime suspect in your book?
Thanks for asking that. You know, people have said, have you ever showed him the book, and has he seen it? But no, he claimed to be, and perhaps truly. He claimed to be 96 years old when I met him in 1966. So,
really?
Unless he's Methuselah, he has passed away a long time ago. So he never
96.
No, he wasn't around in 1980 when I wrote the book.
Amazing, 96 years old. That is
I carried the torch for him because he wasn't there to do it, and I stand on the shoulders of all the mentors. And I have a tremendous gratitude toward their place in my life. Each of us has our own lineage. Each of us stands on the shoulders of others. And so I'm doing my best to carry on with my own particular talents and weaknesses. I'm doing my best to continue to make a positive difference in the world. And I just do so through my books. And for those who don't have much money, they can go to a library or get it used. I always appreciate someone buying a book because, you know, I'm an author. It's how I support my family. And I also teach seminars for those who have the income and the time. There's certainly, as you mentioned, quite an opportunity to get some in-depth work done. And on the Peaceful Warrior Life Purpose Cruise to Alaska, not only people are going to get a fantastic, awe-inspiring beauty of Alaska and ports of call, six different ports of call, but on board ship we're going to have 14 hours a couple hours a day of seminar time where we're going to really explore in depth the four purposes of life so people will be able to get a profound sense of clarity on what they're here to do and they'll have a map where they didn't before about life. So we're looking forward. I never know who's going to show up to the party, but it's always fun to see.
Would it be too invasive for us to ask what the four paths of life are?
Well, no, it's not invasive at all. It's not a secret, but if I say it, they become labels. They become, oh, yeah, I know that already, but no, we go into it in a way that we understand the applications and implications much better. But sure, I'll mention what they are. The one is we've already been talking about, the one I describe in my book, The Life You Were Born to Live, that we're going to go into more depth, and that is a karmic life path. It's like a mountain we're here to climb this lifetime, some unfinished business we need to resolve in the positive. And so that describes one of the purposes. Another has to do with one we all share. We're here to learn and evolve in the school of daily life. And I'm going to go into that in much more depth, including the 12 gateways that we're all facing in everyday life to free our attention and begin to be ready for a more illumined condition in life. That's the second gateway. They're not in any particular order here. A third has to do with the one we normally think of as our life purpose, which is our calling, our form of service in the world, our work in the world. How do we fit in? How do we connect with other people? And the last purpose, I'm going to leave a little mysterious, but I'm going to say it's the most important one of all.
And that is? A little mysterious.
As I said, I'm going to leave that a little mysterious right now.
You know, it's interesting that you should be talking about, you know, and a number of times throughout our conversation, as I read the book, for whatever reason, this issue of labels kept coming back to me, because you're absolutely correct. It seems that we have these little jars, and we place a step or a process or something on it, and then we go about to fill the jar with all the things that we think belong to that label, and we end up sealing the jar tightly, and nothing else seems to get in or get out. And it's unfortunate, because it is it's really a blend of so many different things. I appreciate hearing this over, and it's really been very, very affirmed to me in The Life You Were Born to Live, A Guide to Finding Your Life Purpose. And I'm serious, people, this is an incredible book. For those of you that have not heard of it, and those of you who have not gotten it, I know 6 girlfriends that ran out to get it as soon as they came home. They all want to do all their families and everything else. It has been an interesting and, to me, non-invasive tool for understanding myself and people around us. I want to thank you for being with us this evening. Dan, it's been incredible. You know, you have been one of my mentors, and I really appreciate that. And I want to now go out and get his latest book, The Wisdom of the Peaceful Warrior. Is that what it's called?
That's correct.
The Wisdom of the Peaceful Warrior. That is Dan's latest book, The Life You Were Born to Live, A Guide to Finding Your Life Purpose. And if you've never read The Peaceful Warrior, and that's an interesting one, 2 or 3 weeks before decided to call you to see if we can get you on. The reason I did was because I was thinking about that book for my best friend's son, and she went out and bought him that book after all this time. And so I'm telling you, it is as pertinent today as any other time in the world, if not more. They all are. They're incredible books, and I want to thank you again for being with us, Dan. Good luck in your cruise. Good luck in all of your endeavors, and keep writing incredible books, because they are incredible books.
Thank you, Basma. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. I wish you and your listeners good journeys.
Thank you so much. For those of our listeners, that tomorrow night we have joining us with our host, David Swanson. David will be interviewing Brad Friedman. He's an investigative citizen journalist / blogger. That was a twist. Political commentator and broadcaster. He is the creator and managing editor of the Brad blog. We're hoping that Ann Coulter will actually call in and argue with him. We've been putting out little feelers here and there. And next Tuesday night, join me with our guest, Senator Lincoln Chafee, author of Against the Tide. He's the only Republican that voted against the Iraq War. That's Tuesday, May 13th, 2008. From 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Thank you all very much. It's been a great show. Dan, thank you, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief fountain, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.